Welcome to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West. Dinosaurs and butterflies have a lot more in common than you would have ever imagined.
Billings resident Marian Lyman Kirst has a master's degree in science journalism from Boston University and currently is finishing up a master's degree in etymology through the University of Florida. With what little time she has free, she collects and identifies insects of South Central Montana and volunteers at the Montana Audubon Center.
And Lewis Hobeck is also a Billings resident with a fine arts degree from the University of Montana. He got an emphasis in photography, but his body of work demonstrates his abilities as a multidisciplinary artist. In 2015, Lewis was selected for an Artist's Innovation Award from the Montana Arts Council. His show of drawings and sculptures of dinosaur heads is currently showing at the Emerson Center for the Arts and Culture in Bozeman, entitled Lepidotorius Ceratopsiae.
Lewis Hobeck and Marian Lyman Kirst discuss the creative process from art making to scientific exploration, butterflies to dinosaurs. Anna, when you first mentioned the show about having Lewis and Marian on the same show, I kept thinking, this is so unusual. Lewis is doing the largest animals that ever roamed the earth, dinosaurs, and Marian is focused on these tiny little insects. I'm leaving it up to you to pull this all together.
It's actually quite a beautiful, creative coming together. Lewis's latest show is on display at the Emerson Center in Bozeman, and it's featuring charcoal drawings of these dinosaur skulls, as well as a handful of charcoal and watercolor butterflies. And a lot of that has been informed, too, by the work that Marian does. So let's dive in. Welcome to the studio, Lewis. Marian, so glad to have you both.
Thank you for having us.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah. So you have also, Lewis, fleshed out sculptures of these dinosaur heads. And I hear that Vera will be on display.
She will.
For those who haven't met Vera, can you please describe?
Well, she's a life-sized Triceratops head sculpture that I made a few years ago. Think 4 feet wide, 6 feet long from the tip of her frill to her beak. That's as accurate as I could make it, talking to paleontologists and doing a lot of research. So she has thousands and thousands of scales. I sculpted each individually. A lot of musculature recreated. And she's black with a Vanitas-inspired still life painted on her frill. So it has flowers and fruit and butterflies, and it's all a morality lesson tale on your mortality and that you will someday die, from the Dutch still life painters back in the 16th centuries.
What possessed you to want to create a life-size Triceratops head?
Well, since I was a kid, I always wanted a dinosaur head for my wall, and it took me years and years to finally get around to making one. And when I was offered the residency at the Art Museum in 2015, it was a short one, but I thought, here's my chance to do a life-size one. So I have this huge space to work with.
Yeah, you have the space, absolutely.
And
I don't imagine you had the space on your wall, though.
It currently does not fit in my house, so.
But it will fit in the Emerson Center, so it'll be a nice chance for people to get to see this.
Yes.
In the flesh, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Very fascinating that you also painted it and then put these still lives that sort of decay, and that comment on how nothing really lasts forever, does it?
Exactly.
So I think it's interesting, Marian, when I was looking at your work, and I know you've been working with the Audubon Center in Billings.
Correct.
But your photographs and those details of insects and bugs, I kept thinking, isn't it interesting that their shapes are very similar to some of the things that Lewis was doing?
Definitely.
The antennas, the horns, all that aspect of it is very similar. One is minuscule and one is enormous.
Definitely. What Lewis was talking about when he said one of the things inspired him was he wanted to actually have this dinosaur skull on his wall. And when I was starting with photography of insects and studying insects, the artistic part came from me thinking about what I would want on the walls of my house. And something that really draws me in about insects is exactly what you mentioned, Corby, is the articulation of their parts. So their antennae and their tarsi and the minute striations on their forewings and hindwings. And I just think that they're like little machines, the way that dinosaurs, you can sort of, when you see some of Lewis's work, especially when he takes the skin off and you see the skeleton, it looks like this perfect machine. And I think that's partly what drew me to Lewis's work as well, is it's the, you kind of, if you took a, for example, a fly, a house fly, and you blew it up, you know, 1,000 times, you would be like, yep, these things would have destroyed us if they were around. I mean, they're just like, they would be like giant dinosaurs, and they have all those beautiful details. And that's definitely, that's part of what draws me to these animals.
I think that's interesting you mentioned that about these perfect machines, because when I was studying the Triceratops head skulls in particular, looking at them and trying to figure out how exactly they evolved, and Triceratops as one species were alive for 3 million years. And so when you think about that, how long humans have been around for, they had perfected that skull shape, and it's so beautiful how it narrows as it goes further out towards its mouth, and then the frill shoots out behind it and it gets wider, and so all the balancing, and then you look at the ball socket on its skull where it hangs on its neck, and it's just so perfectly balanced, and it's just amazing.
It's really interesting to think about these two very different species in relation to mortality. Something so fragile as the butterfly has existed for eons and is still with us. And yet, you know, the seemingly indestructible dinosaur went extinct so very long ago. How does this factor into your artistic process, or how did these two things even come together in your mind?
Yeah, that's it's a fun exploration. That I was doing research with butterflies because I started to use them in my artwork a few years ago. And through my research, I discovered that they were contemporaries. So butterflies were flying around when dinosaurs were here. And the wings on butterflies are covered in scales. I'm sure Marion could tell us countless tales about those.
Scales.
Scales,
I guess
you
wouldn't have ever thought about them being scaled.
Exactly. When you look at a microscope, insects are so much more complex than they appear. But then also the horns on the Ceratopsian dinosaurs, there's come in such a wide variety of shapes and sizes that obviously they were for defensive things because they're made of bone with a keratin sheath like cow horns are, but they also were too diverse to be just for defense. So there had to be some display purposes, some species identification, some mating ritual things attached
to
that.
Sexual selection, probably.
Exactly. And so it's the same with insects. Their wings are very structural and functional, but they're also huge surfaces for display. We don't know what colors the dinosaurs were, but it's very probable that they're bright and flashy. They were used for camouflage, for deterring predators, the same way butterfly wings are. Saying, I'm orange and black, I'm probably poisonous, or having big eye spots to scare away predators like the owls and everything.
So, Marion, I know that you've lived in China, and I'm just wondering, you know, when we think of dinosaurs, where did they roam? And you're looking at insects from two different parts of the world, from eastern Montana and China. Are there similarities, or can you trace in terms of insects and bugs where they came from, their sort of evolution like we try to do with dinosaurs?
You definitely can. You know, there's people that look at that, the evolutionary migrations of certain insects when we're talking about butterflies and moths and where they migrated. But one of the problems with insect evolutionary history is that, unlike dinosaurs, where you have a lot of solid hard parts that fossilize really well, with insects you have mostly, especially with things like butterflies, which I'll take a quote from David Quammen, one of our state's great writers, who said that butterflies are basically just caterpillars strung between two kites, which I love. And the caterpillar, you know, a caterpillar is just so squishy and soft. And the only real hard part of a caterpillar, the larval stage of a butterfly and moth, is the head capsule. Otherwise, everything is so degradable and so fragile. And so the evolutionary history of Lepidoptera is really not very clear. One of the best preserved butterflies comes from the fluorescent fossil beds, and it's dated to about 40 million years ago. And they actually think, while there were butterflies flying around with dinosaurs, the oldest Lepidoptera are moths. And there's a theory right now that suggests that butterflies are just brightly colored moths. And that's kind of an interesting sort of thought experiment too, because butterflies are often, when you think about insects, they're the ones that get most of the attention, but it might just be moths.
Sure, or even the idea, like back to Lewis's process too, like dinosaurs, we don't know what color they were. We don't know necessarily if they were brightly colored, or theories certainly are that they were. And then to take their bones and to recreate, not only from a lifelike standpoint what it perhaps looked like, but then from a creative standpoint to use it as a canvas to mm-hmm. paint all of these imaginary descriptions of them.
I have an idea. I think you guys should be consultants for a new Pixar movie, Butterflies and Dinosaurs. I mean, the idea of it being contemporaries is so fascinating.
Yeah. Well, and there's that, I mean, it would go, you kind of could use that old saying, or that thought experiment about if you go back in time and like a dinosaur steps on a butterfly way back when, does it completely change the present now? And that would be, I think, pretty fun. Yeah.
I love this storyline. I want to come back to the artistic process because, Lewis, you are working in charcoal, and charcoal is a black medium, obviously. So mm-hmm. I know that there, some of the pieces at the show will be watercolor, so we're going to be seeing some of these colored butterflies. But a lot of the skull drawings are in charcoal. Tell me why you chose that medium.
Well, partially, charcoal is very quick to work in, so I could do very big drawings to give you a kind of a sense of the actual scale. They're not quite life size, but they're closer than if you were to just do, you know, small pencil drawings or something. Also, I like the concept of the materiality being burned organic matter, and you get these rich velvety blacks with charcoal that I just fell in love with in college, but I never used to use it because it's so messy. But I decided to try and embrace it, and I've been doing a lot of work with it in the last few months, and it's been going very well. And it also, if I were to use paint or just drawings with pencil, it would be more like scientific drawings that I didn't want to do, because a lot of these species are only described with just a fragment of the skull. And through the fossilization process, a lot of these skulls have been twisted and morphed and disfigured to the point where we can't accurately tell exactly how they look. So I wanted them to be more mysterious, kind of fading into this black, misty atmosphere. And so they're not quite clear. They're kind of obscured. And I thought charcoal would be the perfect medium for that.
I love the medium of charcoal. I don't know if you know Bentley Spang's drawings that he did, mm-hmm. A Cheyenne Indian artist. And part of his family ranch burned, and he took out sheets of paper and rubbed them across the trees. And they're fabulous paintings. But he also talked about the temporal quality of charcoal and the deepness and the richness you get from that, that's so different from any other medium.
Yes, it's a very impermanent medium. And I like that with the idea of dinosaurs, they're not here anymore. Butterflies are so delicate. And this idea of life and death and everything so transient and fleeting.
You have some drawings of butterflies. You're looking at them just maybe from a folded standpoint. So you've just got half of the view of them, and mm-hmm. you've been really exploring those different wing patterns. And I think, Marion, that's perhaps where your information came in to help inform what these species were, or what maybe their markings indicate. How are you guys working together on those projects?
I mean, it wasn't anything too spectacular. I just Lewis needed some help identifying some of the specimens that I think he wanted to use as models, Lewis. Or I don't know if you're going to paint the exact ones. But it was really fun for me because I got to just go practice my IDing skills. And you're right, with butterflies, especially with the really showy ones, most of the butterflies that Lewis gave to me were papilionids. So they're swallowtail butterflies, and their wing patterns and their wing shape is very diagnostic. And so it was fun to be able to go in and try to figure out what these butterflies are. Yeah, it was
good. When I started sculpting the Triceratops a few years ago, I talked to paleontologists to get as much information from people who are in the field and dedicating their life to it as possible. Because I don't have the time. I love science and I love researching. But so that's why I like talking with Marion, because she's further into this than I'll probably ever be. Not to say that I don't like learning about it, but that's why I like talking to her, because she just informs me and can point out things that I would have missed potentially, and then I can clue those in mine. So I'm trying to create these scientifically relevant pieces, but that are also beautiful and have this kind of elevation and artistic sensibilities.
And I think that's what's so special about Lewis's work, too, is I think he is one of the rare artists right now who is combining those, the sort of scientific aspect and the artistic aspect, in a really beautiful and meaningful way. I think a lot of people think if you're going to illustrate species, you either take the pure natural history approach, where it looks mm-hmm. like a field guide, or you take a really abstract approach, and it's sort of like, here's a very washy butterfly silhouette, or you know, here's sort of an abstract dinosaur. But Lewis manages to get the details without it feeling really pedantic, and then he also, it's also just beautiful. It's something you want to put on the wall, and totally belongs in an art museum. Could find its home in both an art museum and a natural history museum.
Seems like this is where your artistic leanings and your interests really do intersect. Mm-hmm. And Marion, you do a lot of macro photography with insects, and you get the most fascinating close-ups of them. And I'm curious about that process. I mean, you're obviously drilling into the realities of these insects, but when you see them so close up, they become whole different creatures.
Yeah, they definitely do. And I'm still very much a novice at macro photography. I've been fortunate to do some workshops with some of the best in the world, but it's definitely going to be a lifetime hobby where you will never learn everything there is to know. And what I'm doing is pretty simple. Anyone really can do this. You just have a little white box. I only photograph live insects. They have to be alive. I don't believe in photographing dead insects for art or for, because I want these pictures on my wall. That's something, that's how I started, is I wanted insects all over my house, that I wanted them all over my house in a very beautiful way. And so I decided to take this sort of white box studio approach to photographing insects, but try to apply portraiture. So the way that people photograph other people, I wanted to bring that to insects, so that you get the details and you get the beauty, but you also might get a little glimpse of their personality. For example, if they're an insect is cleaning its eyeball with its foreleg, you can, you know, I could capture that and you could see that close up. That was sort of what I was really trying to do with my macro photography. And so it's not straight. It's not straight natural history photography. I do work in situ, so I do like to go out in the wild and take macro photos, but I'm not great at that yet. I'm still learning for sure. But that's sort of, yeah, that's where my interest is in terms of getting these insects really close up for myself.
It's got to be nearly impossible to get them to sit still.
I will tell you that I have an incredibly patient husband who has put up with a lot of runaway insects and spiders, and he often, for some of the more some of the venomous or you know, potentially more dangerous insects, there really aren't that many, but ones that could give you a good bite, I have my husband help me wrangle them, so he stands by with a Tupperware cup, and if it gets out of the light box, then he puts the cup over.
So, like, they don't behave? Is that what you're
right,
saying?
Right, exactly.
You can't really corral a couple bugs?
Definitely, and you know, it's really species-dependent. There's a lot of groups that are super photogenic, and they make awesome subjects, and they like to look at you. Jumping spiders are one of those. They love to engage with you. They have one of the best visions of all invertebrates, and they will sit there and look at you and wiggle their adorable wizard-like
I'm glad that you're doing that instead of me.
It's pretty fun. I will say that one trick, if people want to try this at home, you put them in a little jar and you put them in the fridge for just a couple minutes, and it cools them down and it slows them down so that you can get some photos, some quick photos, before they warm back up and get too busy again.
What brought you to this love of insects? It seems like a very unique hobby.
I've got two words for you, Anna. David Attenborough.
Okay.
Yes. I've always been interested in the kind of traditionally uncharismatic animals of the world. And in college, my favorite was pallid sturgeon, and that's why I did my environmental studies thesis on pallid sturgeon recovery in the Upper Missouri River Basin. And then not too long after that, I don't remember when or where I saw it, but I saw Life in the Undergrowth that David Attenborough hosts, and it changed my, basically just changed my life. It was, I could not believe that there was a world like this. And the way that he talks about them with such love, it didn't matter that they were not, 400 pounds. It didn't matter that they weren't fuzzy. It didn't matter. He spoke about them with such reverence, with as much reverence as he would a panda bear or a blue whale. And there was none of this sort of hammy, Jaws-like music accompanying the entrance of a wolf spider. There was Spanish flamenco music that was narrating their mating rituals, and I just was thought that this was exactly how natural history should be done.
So does living in Montana have something to do with both your interests? When you mention the sturgeon, people don't really know what those animals look like. I mean, they are so ancient and unbelievable. And the fact that there's so many dinosaur skulls in Montana, does that have something to do with your interest? Or?
Well, I think when you really get down to it, dinosaurs are, or at least some species of dinosaurs, are more Montana animals than bison and horses and all the ones that we think of as traditionally Western animals. They were here. I guarantee they walked right where we're sitting right now for millions of years. So I think that's kind of cool. Like, it's still very location-based, but it's just out of time that I'm working in.
Exactly. And then where Lewis is working out of time, I feel like I'm working just at a different scale. Yeah, he's absolutely right. I think it's a way to look at Montana from a natural history perspective that's very different from what is commonly the common approach to looking at Montana wildlife. And I think that's pretty cool.
You're looking down, I'm looking backwards.
Exactly.
I like, Marion, how you described some of these, your interest at least, in the uncharismatic creatures. And Lewis, your work too has been based in imagination, and you create these very wild creatures. I've seen masks that you've made and wall mounts of these imaginary animals that have a backstory, and they're not all pretty, and they don't bat their beautiful eyelashes, and they're nothing out of a Disney movie. So do you tend to fall for the uncharismatic creature?
Absolutely. As a kid, I would visit a lot of houses that had taxidermy wall mounts, and as you do in Montana. And I always wonder about their history and their stories. And so I took that later in life as trying to figure out what are their personalities like. So the creatures I sculpt, they all have stories. They all have a story you can read on their faces, as with portraiture in humans. And I also do a lot of drawings and illustrations with animals wearing clothes and in suits. And so their posture, the actual clothes that they're wearing, they all tell a story as to what their occupations are, what their personalities are like. And so I like giving hints to the viewers as to what I'm thinking that these animals have, but then also leaving enough open to interpretation.
Lewis, I like your paintings that you've been doing too, those small paintings, because as Marion mentioned, you get the hint or the nuance of the insect, but then they're very loose paintings. Mm-hmm. You're not doing a scientific illustration. You identify the animal, and then it becomes a really nice palette for a painting, not an illustration.
Yeah. And Marion works with live animals. I work with dead. So with these paintings especially, they're all a prima, so it's just all in one go of oil paint. And so I'm trying to work loosely and then also get a feeling of life, of movement with the paint, which is sometimes very difficult because sometimes the specimens I'm working with are very, very obviously decaying and falling apart. But I like that feeling of movement and life out of death.
And that's important to note too, is that Lewis isn't killing these these insects that they're found objects that which I think is so lovely, especially from an entomological perspective, that these dead insects that someone just found in a dusty corner of their room get a second chance to be beautiful through Lewis, which is fantastic.
Sure,
they don't just get thrown in the garbage.
Yeah, I'd imagine a lot of these come from butterfly pavilions or other places where they live out their natural lives, and then you're able to use them as models.
Well, and didn't some of your oil painting subjects come from just a friend who found some, like, on?
Yeah, when my friends found a bunch of little butterflies and tiny little envelopes in an estate sale many years ago, and the really cool ones, they have dates and the species and where they were found written on there. So there's some from the 20s. And they're obviously in poor shape, kind of falling apart and dusty, but they're still beautiful.
So take note, if you have any found insects, Lewis has a space for them. And if you might need an insect rescued out of your home, Marion might be the one to call.
Absolutely. Do not kill those black widows. I will come and get them.
Nice. Well, we'll definitely have more information online about the show that is currently at the Emerson Center in Bozeman. It is on display through November 30th, so you can check out Lewis's work in the flesh, so to speak. And I had one more question. I wanted to come back to this idea of the contrast between the realities of all of these scales that you created with this life-size Triceratops head. I think it's so fascinating that you worked to get such incredible detail and lifelike structure to this replication of this dinosaur head. And yet then you can also be so playful and imaginative on the other side with some of your other creations. How do those two things come together for you, the reality and the imagination?
Well, I think it's just a blending of how I think. I'm very mathematically and scientifically inclined, but at the same time, I am very creative. And I like the idea of science. And when I was in school, I never wanted to go into a science job because it felt too constricting to me. And so this way, I can still do all the research. I can talk to other friends, other scientists, and read publications and still present my research in an artistic and creative manner for the general public, which would never have access to this kind of information, and do it in a way that's I think, a little more beautiful and a little more refined.
And Marion, that parallels certainly your interest in photographing live insects. Because it's certainly easier to look at something with a pin through its body. But the personality, it sounds like, of these insects comes through when they're alive and you're taking pictures of them.
Yeah, it absolutely does. I'm a huge fan of leaf beetles in particular. They're such sweethearts. They are just, they're these small little kind of globular beetles, and they have the most adorable little heart-shaped foot pads, and they tend to hunker down at first. They're not so sure about you, and they kind of play dead for a little bit, but you give them a couple minutes and they pop right back up. They're super tenacious. They'll just keep on walking until you give them a little touch, and then they hunker down again. They're very sweet. And I also am a huge fan of assassin bugs, which it's a great name for one thing. They're mega predators in the undergrowth, and they are not afraid of you. They will stand their ground, and they'll put their antennae up like legs and look like they're about to try to box you. But they're super fun to photograph. And you get to sort of, you know, you definitely are anthropomorphizing to some extent, but you get to know these little creatures, and it is very rewarding.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.